This is Audible.
You're listening to the audio production of Capital Gains, Smart Things I Learned Doing Stupid Stuff by Chip Gaines, published by Thomas Nelson and read by Chip Gaines. Forward written and read by Joanna Gaines.
Forward by Joanna Gaines. As you may have already heard, choosing the cover photo of this book was quite the process. At first, I was like everyone else when I told Chip he needed to pick a safer option. I told him no one would get the raw and candid one, and it may be a bit confusing for the actual cover. But the more I heard Chip talk about why he loved this picture so much, the more I started to see his point of view. For one thing, you can clearly see the wishbone-shaped scar on his forehead. He got that scar after doing something pretty stupid, but the life lesson not only marked him, but changed him forever. This experience seems to perfectly embody the subtitle of this book. He also loved the idea that this picture was shot on the farm, on the way to a photo shoot. Hat on backward, no touch-ups, no fancy camera lights, just a man on his ATV riding through a pasture. This reminds me so much of when Chip talks about how life isn't about arriving at the farm. Instead, it's what happens on the way to the farm. For us, the farm is our dream. Most people have an ideal life that they imagine for their future, something that they work toward and dream of. This is what the farm represents to us. And yet the point Chip makes is that life didn't start here. We didn't get happier. We didn't become the people we were always meant to be once we got to the farm. All those things were worked out during the journey that led us there. That was the essential part. That was where the endless choices existed, the ones that determined who we were going to be and what kind of story we were going to tell with our lives. You can arrive at your dream a lot of different ways, but you also arrive there as a different version of yourself based on whatever pathway you choose. I love this book for a lot of reasons, but mostly because it's about what happened on the way. Chip is a good man. I could not be more proud to be his wife, antics and all. But he didn't land on the farm and suddenly become the hard-working man of character he is. He, like all of us, was forged in the daily choosing. This book inspires me once again to live even more intentionally on the way. None of us has arrived. We are all just figuring this thing out as we go. But being by Chip's side, I can't help but want to live braver, to dream bigger, and to hold family even closer. My hope is that when you read this book, you are reminded to not let your mistakes or shortcomings define you. In fact, I hope you see that these are the actual opportunities for you to choose to be the person you always hoped to be. To enjoying the journey, Joanna.
Author's note. I've never been one to give luck much credit. But you've got your hands on this book for one reason or another, so let's just assume that this happened for a reason. That said, for this period of time that we're together, I'd like to be your coach and have you on my team. I'll always shoot you straight. To start, your time as a spectator has officially ended. I'm putting you in the race. I want us to work this thing out together, side by side. I'm going to run this leg of the race with you, but get ready because in the end, I'm going to hand you the baton. Sincerely, Chip. There's a time for everything, and a season for every activity under the heavens. A time to be born, and a time to die. A time to plant, and a time to uproot. A time to kill, and a time to heal. A time to tear down, and a time to build. A time to weep, and a time to laugh. A time to mourn, and a time to dance. A time to scatter stones, and a time to gather them. A time to embrace, and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to search, and a time to give up. A time to keep, and a time to throw away. A time to tear, and a time to mend. A time to be silent, and a time to speak. A time to love, and a time to hate. A time for war, and a time for peace. Ecclesiastes 3:1-8. Part 1, A Time to Learn. Chapter 1, Failure to Launch. I was a normal kid as far as I knew. I didn't feel any different from the other kids in my first grade class. I rode the bus just like everybody else, traded baseball cards during recess, and never let my mom send me to school with a sack lunch on pizza day. Despite the striking similarities between my classmates and me, one simple fact set us apart. I had yet to learn my ABCs. In case you accidentally glossed over the first paragraph, I was in the first grade. I wasn't 3 or 4. I was 7.5 years old. Yet here I was, struggling to read basic sentences. The first grade teachers at my elementary school split their classes into 4 different reading groups. At first, I didn't think anything of it. There were just different teams with cool bird mascots. There were the Eagles, the Falcons, the Blue Jays, and of course, the Mighty Penguins, the group I was a proud member of. I was the only penguin in Miss Redding's class, although there were definitely a few others scattered throughout the first grade. I'm not sure exactly how she decided who was going to go into what group, but I do know that when it was time to read, the penguins were ushered out of our individual classrooms and into the gym. And just so you're getting the full picture here, it was a great big gymnasium, holding about 15 kids, some of whom had been diagnosed with actual learning disabilities, and me. I knew it wasn't normal, that I couldn't read yet, but it had never occurred to me that it was something to be embarrassed about. It's possible that the other kids in my class made fun of me as soon as I skipped off to the gym, but if they did, I never knew it. In fact, the thought of that ever happening never even crossed my mind. My positive outlook has blinded me to plenty of things over the years. Maybe it has even protected me at times from things I didn't need to see. Have you ever heard the phrase, looking at the world through rose-colored glasses? Well, if there was ever a poster child for this, it would have been me. And even now, I am just fine seeing the world through those lenses. This typically leads me to see the best in people rather than the worst. I've always had the ability to play things out to the positive. Here's how that mindset played out back in the first grade. Kids can be cruel. So looking back, there's a decent chance that at least one of the kids in my class was calling me names while I was off learning to recite my ABCs. But rather than think about that possibility, I was excited that I was invited to the gym in the first place. Honored even. Look, any chance to go to the gymnasium was a win in my book. I loved getting to see the other penguins. We really only got good time together on Thursday afternoons from 1 until 2:45. I'd walk in there and be like, "What? Where have you guys been? Wait, do you guys get to hang out in the gym all week? How did you score that? Luckies?" Looking back, I'm not sure if the act of labeling our group as penguins was random or not, but the symbolism isn't lost on me. All the other bird species in my first grade reading class could fly, except the penguins. Penguins are flightless birds. But that doesn't mean that they're less than. They're actually incredible birds. They do exactly what they were made to do. So while I was happy as a lark to be a penguin, I sure hope my gym mates never let that label define them. I hope that they realize that despite the fact that penguins can't fly, they can do something those other birds can't do. Penguins can swim. Some of the greatest success stories of all time came from people who were misunderstood or even miscategorized. Maybe their strengths weren't noticed or valued. Perhaps they got a slow start or went about things in an unusual manner. They somehow didn't fit into the world's narrow definition of what constitutes achievement or success. Here are just a few of them. Famous failures. Penguin edition. Walt Disney. He was told that he didn't have enough imagination and therefore was fired from his newspaper job at the Kansas City Star. Can you believe that? Walt freaking Disney. Albert Einstein, the person who allegedly didn't speak until he was 4 years old and didn't read until he was 7, sound familiar? Basically invented science. Oprah Winfrey. She was supposedly fired from her job as a reporter because she couldn't separate her emotions from her work. And wouldn't you know it, that same inability to separate work and emotions was one of the qualities that made us all fall in love with her. That attribute made her stand out among a world of journalists. Michael Jordan, the man, the myth, the legend. He was cut from his high school basketball team and still went on to become arguably the greatest basketball player of all time. You know, he believed he could fly. I really could share stories like this all day long. They're my favorite kinds of biographies to read and the types of tales I can't help but recount to anyone who will listen. the journey of some underdog slugging and fighting all the way to the top against all odds is infinitely more inspiring to me than the story of the golden child who was born with all the right stuff. So maybe Miss Redding and the other first grade teachers were onto something. Maybe they intentionally categorized my gym buddies and me as penguins because they saw something unique in us. Or maybe this is just the way my mind works. I've got a glass half full outlook on life. I tend to believe I can truly do or be anything. There are no limits to things I believe I can accomplish. So yeah, I have a low tolerance for people who tend to disqualify themselves from ever amounting to much before they even try. Or for people who are constantly their own worst critic. I realize you didn't sign up for a motivational speaking course, but I'm going to take a few liberties here and suggest that if there are external voices telling you that you're nothing special or that you'll never amount to anything, you should probably choose some different people to surround yourself with. And if that unkind voice is your own, I'd like to encourage you to start challenging those thoughts. You were uniquely created for a purpose. And I have no clue what that purpose is for you specifically, but I am perfectly confident that you do, in fact, have one. And you would be wise to stop being your own biggest obstacle. Your purpose is just like mine. It's big and it's important, and there's no one else anywhere on the planet who can fulfill it. So quit jacking around and let's get after it. Chapter 2, The Boys of Summer. I have spent 50% of my life throwing a baseball, and not just throwing, but hitting, taking infield and outfield, working on the fundamentals of the game. My cleats, my glove, my hat, and that number 16 jersey are the only uniform I've ever known. At one point in my life, I genuinely thought sunflower seeds were a major food group. I didn't care what I wore to class in high school or even college. I could have shown up half-dressed and probably wouldn't have even thought twice about it, but the way I cared for every part of that red, white, and blue baseball uniform was a different story. It epitomized my love for the game. I spent a good chunk of my time trying to get my baseball hat to fit just right. To help shape the bill, I would bend it incessantly and wrap multiple rubber bands around it. Then I would run it through the dishwasher a couple of times to make it a little more pliable. This was a good starting point, but I had to mess with the bill constantly to get it to fit just perfect. And that was just the hat. Before a game, I would spend time scrubbing the grass stains out of my pants to make sure that they were bright white. I figured that the cleaner my uniform was going into the game, the more evident my hard work would be afterward. It was like a scorecard to me. The state of my pants by the ninth inning was a direct reflection of how hard I'd played that day. If they were truly filthy, bloody even, I knew that I had left everything out on the field. And my glove? Now that's a whole nother story. It was like an extension of myself. Something about it was just magic to me. When I put it on, I felt invincible, like the whole world was at my feet. When I was a kid, my dad had a sporting goods store, and you can imagine the type of playground that was for a sports enthusiast like my dad and me. I'm telling you, I grew up in that little store. Come spring, my favorite tradition was going to pick out my new glove. I remember trying every last glove on in that entire shop, and Dad and I would weigh out the pros and cons of each particular unit. Actually landing on which glove to go with was just the beginning, though. The fun part was breaking it in. I'd get home and immediately rub oil into the palm and soften up the leather a bit. I'd start hitting it, fist to the mitt style, trying to get it just right. This could go on for hours. The final trick was to roll it up like you would a newspaper, put a ball inside of it, and then tuck it under my mattress for the night. The anticipation of waking up the next morning to go try the new glove for the first time made it almost impossible to sleep. Literally, as soon as the sun even thought about rising, I was out in the front yard breaking in my glove with Dad. We'd toss the ball back and forth, trying to decide how many more nights I'd need to sleep with it under my mattress before it was game ready. I poured my entire life into that game. Baseball was the center of my universe, this one singular activity around which everything else orbited. School, family, friends, church, weekends, and any available free time that I had. Baseball somehow managed to take precedence, and everything else fell in line after it. The only reason I even tried in school was so that I could make the grades to play baseball. Education was simply a means to an end. When baseball was going well, my life was going well. But as soon as one thing went wrong, it seemed as though all other areas of my life started to fall apart at the seams. It was a snowball effect, a chain reaction. So I pushed hard to make sure that every aspect of the game was perfect. There was literally no room for error. My dad, a constant, persistent, and faithful coach, was right there with me every step of the way. He taught me that if I would do the hard work and never quit, I would be successful. Dad had played college football, and he was as passionate about his sport as I was about mine. He would have loved for me to have been more excited about football, but baseball was my thing. I chose it, and Dad got on board with me 100%. I can't tell you how much I respect him for setting aside his own wishes for mine. His support drove me to work even harder. He encouraged me to hit farther, run faster, and throw harder. In light of my dad's high expectations, I pushed myself more and more. I woke up earlier and stayed up later. I was dedicated to my dream of playing baseball, and he was my biggest cheerleader. Nothing compared to the satisfaction of making my dad proud. And now, being on the other side of things, I get it. Nothing beats getting to see the smile on any of my kids' faces when one of them gets a hit or steals second. Baseball was this incredible opportunity, a conduit, really, for Dad and me to develop a deep relationship with one another. We spent hours together every single day. The only problem was that we artificially attached ourselves and our relationship to this sport, this one activity. The bond between us was completely built on baseball. It was our cornerstone, the factor on which everything else was based. Love and pride and encouragement were all contingent on how well I played every single game, literally game by game. If I was firing on all cylinders, Dad couldn't have been prouder. We'd high-five and recount every play for hours, reminiscing, really on cloud nine. But if things didn't go so well, the subsequent hours would look much different. We'd drive home from the ball field in complete silence. Dad would sometimes storm into the house, slamming the door behind him. And I clearly remember thinking, my dad doesn't love me because of the way I just played. I wasn't able to separate my performance from Dad's feelings towards me. Back then, our relationship just hadn't developed beyond the expectations of a perfect performance in a game. Looking back now, I realized two things. Number one, my dad wanted to be with me. We both loved sports, so if there was a sport to play, he was right there by my side, playing it with me, or at the very least, cheering me on. And number two, my father wanted me to be the very best. The very, very best. And I love him for that. My dad didn't really have a dad. He was very young when his father chose to leave his family. So every idea my dad had about how to be a father either came from a book or from some other man he looked up to. Without having a direct example of his own, he just expected me to be what he assumed other dads expected from their sons. Or maybe in his heart, he was just paying me the attention he wished his old man would have paid him had he decided to stick around. I know without a doubt that my dad loves me and is proud of me and did his very best to be a great father. So I'm not complaining. But Dad and I both had a little growing up to do, because a relationship centered around just one thing has its drawbacks, especially when that one thing goes away. I've heard about 6% of high school players actually play college ball. And then, of those lucky few, only 8% get drafted into the major leagues. Now, I'm no mathematician, but that had to make my chances of playing professional baseball less than 0.5%. But I didn't care. I still lived and breathed that game. To me, there was no scenario in which I didn't end up playing college baseball, and then going pro, no matter what the odds were. Towards the end of high school, everyone I know was working hard to build a hefty college application portfolio. They were taking internships, joining academic clubs and debate teams, running for class treasurer, you know, the more easily achievable class office position. And on top of all that, going to numerous obligatory college visits. But not me. I was doing one thing and one thing only, playing baseball. Baseball was my trajectory. It was my plan A, and there was no plan B. As it turned out, all those hours and days and years of practicing really paid off. I actually beat the odds and made it onto a college team. It was surreal to finally be walking into the dream that I had imagined for so long, playing baseball for Baylor University in Waco, Texas. But let's not celebrate too soon, because in my sophomore year, I was cut, just like that, with no warning whatsoever. The news hit me like a sucker punch to the gut, and in the following months, I fell into something I can only describe as a deep depression. The only dream I'd ever known was crushed. The weight of that held me down for the better part of that year. There are lots of people who don't dream big enough dreams. That has never been my problem. My problem was that my dream was actually too big for me. And when that dream was lost, I was lost too. Dozens of well-meaning friends and family members suggested possible alternatives to help me move beyond my funk. Every single recommendation, all of them, fell flat. I wasn't having any of it. But hiding away in my dorm room, fooling myself into believing I wasn't made to do anything other than play this game, wasn't going to work forever. Apparently there's a cap to the amount of self-pity time a person gets, because one morning I woke up and realized it was time to snap out of it. The time had come for me to get on with my life. It wasn't long after that I remembered sitting in a business class and looking out the window at a man riding a lawnmower. I was mesmerized as I watched the blades of freshly cut grass billow into the air. Then I thought, that guy has it all figured out. Why am I sitting here learning concepts and hypothetical business principles while he's out there grabbing the bull by the horns and actually making stuff happen? It's those seemingly small, fortifying moments in our lives that often end up being the instrumental ones. So as the second hand hit 12 and signaled the end of class, I closed my spiral notebook, zipped up my backpack, turned my hat around backwards, and walked out the door. I marched right down toward that landscaper, confident that he alone held the answers that would save me from my agony and my floundering. While I was questioning him a little bit about his job, I noticed he seemed a bit caught off guard by my interest in his work. I imagine that what he felt in that moment was similar to the way I'd felt in the classroom so many times before. I related to feeling completely unprepared to handle questions fired off by probing professors. After beating around the bush for too long and asking him stupid questions about mowing grass, I was finally able to pry out of him how I'd go about getting a job from the company he worked for. It wasn't as easy as one might think to get hired by a landscaping company. But I eventually sealed the deal. But let's fast forward past me mowing a bunch of lawns to get to the good part. It was early August when the owner of the landscaping company I'd been working for took me aside to talk. He told me that he thought it would be smart for me to start my own landscaping business. Without even meaning to, he drew the same type of confidence out of me that I felt when a coach or my dad would call me out and give me advice or encouragement. That was the very moment when I finally knew what I was going to do for the rest of my life, what I felt truly passionate about, not necessarily mowing grass, but dreaming up and starting businesses. It was the day I knew I was going to be an entrepreneur. Getting cut from baseball was something I never saw coming, and looking back, I can see that it could have played out one of several ways. First possibility. I could have dropped out of college and spent my days lying around the house with my five lazy roommates, eating a sick amount of pizza, and getting really good at video games like RBI baseball. My backup plan of moving back in with my parents and having my mom wash my whitey-tighties didn't sound so bad either. The passion had been knocked out of me, and there was seemingly nothing good that could fill its place. Another possibility would have been to suck it up and get a part-time job to occupy my time, just a random job that I didn't care too much about, but that at least paid the bills. Sure, it would have meant giving up on all of my dreams, but at this point, I would have just resigned myself to barely getting by. This option involves zero risk, and there's something really appealing about not rising again after being hurt so profoundly. And although it didn't sound as good as playing Nintendo all day, it at least would get me out of the house. Another possibility would have been to use every instinct and skill I developed over the years, find a new passion, and then go for it. I'd get off the couch and be okay with just hanging up my cleats so that I could pursue something different. And even if this new direction was different from what I'd always dreamt about, I would refuse to quit. Sure, it took me a few months to get my head on straight, but I was resolved to figure this all out. I'm smart enough to know that when you put in the effort and find a new passion and get back on track, good things are bound to happen. This last scenario is just about the way it turned out. I may have dipped my toes into option 1 and 2, but option 3 was what all of those years prior had equipped me for. So instead of becoming chronically despondent or detached, I chose a different approach. It took everything inside of me to step up to the plate again, but I did it, and then I gave it all I had. Each and every year, as the smell of fresh-cut grass heralds the approach of springtime, baseball season commences, and all is right with the world. The very elements of the game, well known as America's favorite pastime, bring me a certain nostalgia, and the old-school romanticism of the sports gets me every time. Now, any time I'm in the stands and tear open a bag of sunflower seeds, I can't help but fall in love with the game all over again. But no matter how much I love the game and the season, I'm always aware that they all must come to an end. In what feels like just a moment, the boys of summer go from being the big men on campus to passing the torch off to the boys of fall. And just like that, it's football season. I've loved baseball as much as anyone, and the lessons it's taught me have proved invaluable. But now, in the end, I know it's just a game. I never, ever thought I'd say this, but it's the truth. If I could go back in time and have my life work out differently, not getting cut from the baseball team, actually making it in baseball, I wouldn't do it. I might still fantasize about what that life could have been like, but ultimately I know that God's plan B has been infinitely greater than my plan A ever could have been. And by the way, my dad was right. Every moment of practice was worth it. None of the passion I invested in baseball turned out to be wasted. Moving on to plan B was hard work, to be sure. And I had to relearn what it meant to never quit. But the 21 years of my life that I spent pursuing baseball taught me the very things I draw upon in my work today. The discipline I learned on the field helped give me the drive to do whatever it takes to keep building. Before anything worthwhile can be built, it needs a strong foundation. I believe each life lesson and every opportunity is a building block on which future experiences are built. And that's definitely true of my life in baseball. I'm confident that I wouldn't have been a successful entrepreneur if it weren't for the things I learned in baseball. It was under those bright lights that grit and scrappy became part of my nature, and fortitude became part of the fiber of my being. I believed the baseball field was the perfect place to train me as a baseball player, but it turned out to be the perfect training ground for me as an entrepreneur. That can be true for you too, no matter what your passion is. Every ounce of energy you invest in pursuing your goals will help you grow towards God's plan for you, even if you end up somewhere you hadn't ever counted on. I can't promise you there won't be any curveballs in your life, but I'm positive that if you'll do the hard work and never quit and pick yourself up when things go sideways, good things will be waiting right around the corner. Chapter 3, Lost in Translation. By the time I was in my mid-20s, I was knee-deep in 3 different businesses. I'd been working with the same group of Mexican guys on all of them. We were a close-knit crew. These were my boys, and something about their culture and their work ethic really resonated with me. It's interesting how when you roll up your sleeve and labor side by side with someone, your stereotypes and assumptions just fall away. I found myself preferring to spend time with these guys over my college buddies, and at first that struck me as kind of strange. Eventually, I just owned the fact that these guys I worked with every day were some of my favorite people in the world. Despite their obvious differences, they somehow reminded me of my granddad, JB. Granddad lived in a different era, a time when people valued honest hard work. and spending days with these guys was somehow like going back in time and getting to spend even a few hours with JB. I had never met a person other than him who could work all day in the blazing hot sun, quite literally from sun up to sundown, and never once complain. But these guys did just that. And because of the weird connection, I almost grew addicted to spending time with my work buddies. And by spending time, of course, I mean working. So that's what I did in my 20s. I worked. All the time. With this great crew of Mexican guys I respected so deeply. What did continue to trip me up, though, was how inadequate I was at speaking their language. When we were on a job site together, they did a pretty good job of getting their points across to me. But I was pretty much useless at meeting them halfway. I would actually merge English with Spanish and come up with my own unique language, which seemed to confuse everyone even more. Or I would use my hands and my face to try to explain to these guys what needed to get done. It was like watching a bad game of charades. Beyond a few basic Spanish terms and a handful of cuss words, I didn't know squat. And for some reason, that really got to me. It seemed the highest level of respect I could show these men was to learn Spanish so that I could really relate to them and also help them better relate to me. This lingering desire to learn the language and submerge myself in their culture had long been in the back of my mind. So when I heard about a Spanish immersion program on the coast of Mexico, I was definitely interested. As I looked into the 3-month-long program and learned more about it, I felt internally resolved to go for it. When I shared the idea with my then-girlfriend Joanna, whom I'd been dating for about 6 months, I was pleasantly surprised at how positive she was about it. I actually couldn't believe it. This girl, who had played it safe her entire life, was really supportive of me going to live in a country where I couldn't even ask where my school was. Looking back, maybe she needed a break or was trying to get rid of me or something. Her support gave me the nudge I needed to quickly get things in order so I could take off for the summer. The only problem with getting things in order was that summers were a very important and somewhat complicated season for at least 2 of the 3 of my businesses. For instance, in my house renting business, most of the college kids I rented to went home for the summer break, even though they had signed 12-month leases. This meant the maintenance and day-to-day obligations became a bit simpler in the summer months, but I also had to chase down rent checks more aggressively than I did during the school year, when the kids were at least in town. On top of that, my landscaping business was highly dependent on this summer revenue, so there were a lot more moving parts during that time. Any of you who own seasonal businesses can probably relate. We made 65 to 70% of our annual revenue during the spring and summer months, and that money was key to our survival during the fall and winter. I decided the only way I could go to Mexico for 3 months was to leave Joe in charge of my businesses. But that was a lot of pressure. If she screwed up in any way at all, chances were my landscaping business wouldn't make it by the time the 3rd and 4th quarter of the year rolled around. The one relief was with so many college kids gone, at least my wash and fold laundry business would be slow during the summer. So that wouldn't add a whole lot more to Joe's already full plate. I called my parents to let them know that I was taking off for 3 months so that I could become fluent in Spanish. At least that was the goal. They weren't quite as supportive of this plan as Joanna was. "Chip, you have multiple businesses," they said. "This isn't college summer vacation anymore, son. Who wouldn't want to go spend a few months on the beach in Mexico? But you have guys who are counting on you now to help feed their families." This negativity really threw me for a loop because it was so out of character for my parents. Even though they sometimes wanted me to play it safe, they had always been my biggest cheerleaders and were the ones who had taught me to just go for it in life. For them to question my plans this way, especially now that I was a pretty well-established grown-up, definitely surprised me. But for some reason, the fact that Joanna was on my side really made this thing feel doable. So against my parents' better judgment, but with Joe's support, I signed on with the program. I was headed to Playa del Carmen for just upward of 90 days, and I was going to learn Spanish if it was the very last thing I did. Joanna was thoughtful enough to throw me a going-away party so that my friends and family could say one last goodbye. No fewer than 80 people came to see me off. I thought it was sweet and all, but it also seemed a little strange, given the fact that I was only going to be gone for about 3 months. Still, I've never been one to turn down a party. I found myself walking around from person to person, explaining how I couldn't wait to drive down and really learn from this culture. I was really working the crowd and gave a pretty touching speech that even made my mom tear up a bit. Looking back, Joe admits she can't imagine what she was thinking or why she encouraged that kind of behavior, but she did. She even ordered me a cookie cake that said, "Adios, amigo." Back then, Joanna had a full-time job keeping the books for her dad at the Firestone dealership in Waco. I was always fascinated with how fast she could enter those numbers on that little calculator with one hand while flipping through the invoice with the other. She worked those numbers like a madwoman and wouldn't come up for air until that last invoice was entered. Joe could reconcile that account down to the penny. I had no doubt that when I left for my trip, my businesses were going to be in great hands. I told all my guys, in very broken Spanish, that if they needed anything pertaining to work, they could find her just up the road at the Firestone from 8 to 5. Somehow, in all of my excitement about leaving, I didn't really think through the fact that what I was expecting of Joe was going to be very difficult. I knew she had a full-time job, but I severely underestimated the amount of effort it would take for her to keep my businesses afloat for the next 3 months. But I kept trying to convince myself that I wasn't asking too much of her. All she had to do was manage 3 irrigation jobs, check in on a retaining wall build, collect rental checks from 30 students on the first of each month, deposit those checks, also on the first of each month, make sure all the subs got paid, check on the campus laundromat 2 times per week to ensure we weren't short on supplies, water my plants, feed my cows, and feed my fish. Of course, I had all this stuff to do before I left. Pack my bag, get cash, make road trip mixtape, go to Paradise Tan and get my base tan. This may be a good time to fill you in on how I kept up with my finances back then. I was pretty much self-taught in all operating procedures as a business owner. It should suffice to say that I didn't actually bother to balance a checkbook. Not to mention, I never really knew how much money I had in the bank. This was a few years before you could just log in and immediately have your whole financial universe at your fingertips. The way I operated was pretty old school. I wrote checks when it felt right. I didn't write them when it didn't. I kept a wad of cash in my pocket, and I knew things were good if it felt pretty thick. I knew to exercise restraint when it felt a bit slender. These businesses were currently responsible for all the extra dinero I was taking with me to make this trip possible. As if my plan weren't complicated enough, just a few days before I left town, I found out that my truck's radiator was overheating. I took it into the repair shop, and they explained that there was a small crack. The radiator would definitely need replacing, but there wasn't money in the budget for a repair like that. So against the advice of the mechanic, I put some radiator sealant in it and prayed the truck would make it to the playa. That's beach in Spanish. Just as I was leaving the shop, he reminded me that I'd better take a 5-gallon jug of water as backup, just in case. That made sense. I figured that between the sealant and stopping every 200 miles or so to fill the radiator up with water, I'd most likely make it. So I loaded up the water jug, along with my suitcase, trusty backpack, and then I grabbed mi perro, that's my dog Shiner, my chow mix mutt of a best friend and a partner in crime, and off we went. Leaky radiator and all. It was a 36-hour drive to the language school, and Shiner and I had budgeted a full week to get there. We allowed time to make plenty of pit stops along the way and not wear ourselves out with the drive. Every couple hundred miles, I would stop to refill my radiator and top that 5-gallon jug off with water. There always seemed to be a little town at about that point where a lone gas station served my purposes perfectly. But then something changed. Wouldn't you know it? 12 hours into this trip, in the middle of the Mexican desert, my truck started to overheat. I'm not great with cars like Joe's dad, but even I was smart enough to realize something was seriously wrong. The radiator had gone from requiring water every 200 or 300 miles to now needing it every 30 miles or so, and I had run out of water. So there I was on the side of the road with a steaming car, hood up, in the middle of nowhere. No town, no gas station. There wasn't a soul in sight. I was still feeling pretty great. After all, two things I love most, problem solving and adventure. Both staring me right in the face. Here I was in the middle of nowhere in a foreign country, languageless, and with this amazing opportunity to overcome all odds. I stood on the roof of my truck to get a better feel for the situation, and I noticed a small stream that looked to be a ways off. I jumped down, grabbed my lasso, picked up the empty 5-gallon jug, and whistled at Shiner. Come on, boy. And we were off. We walked what seemed to be at least a mile in that hot sun to the stream I'd seen, filled up the jug, and were on our way back to the truck when we happened upon a lone Brahma bull. I've been around lots of cattle in my day, but I can tell you for a fact that there's just something different about a Mexican bull. How we'd managed to not see him on the way to the stream was a moot point. Regardless of how he had gotten there, he was now between us and the truck, and he was fired up. I must have looked like a straight-up clown with my mutt, my 5-gallon jug of water, which weighed about 40 pounds full, and my cheap lasso running for my life from a bull in the middle of God knows where. The more I defended myself against this raging animal, the more precious water I lost. And that dang lasso seemed to be doing more harm than good. The only thing saving me now was Shiner's ferocious defense. By this point, the jug had become so light, I could actually use it to strike the beast, which was the equivalent of tickling him with a feather. We finally made it around him and onto the other side of that pasture, and in that moment, I was honestly just glad to be alive. I quickly poured what was left of the agua, see what I'm doing here, into my scalding radiator, and I can still remember the sizzling sound it made. I had drenched that pasture and the bull with most of the water my truck desperately needed just to make it down the road, and there was no way I was going to cross that bull's path again to go back to that far-off stream. My vehicle limped along for about 5 miles or so until we just happened upon a little gas station. I'm not going to sugarcoat this here. Had that station been any further away, both Shiner and I might have died like Pancho and Lefty in the middle of that Mexican desert. Luckily, there was an attendant on site, and due to our inability to communicate, I invited myself to look around that place and rummage through the back of his shop. As I opened drawers, I happened to have come across a half-used tube of JB Weld. If you've never heard of it, it's basically an industrial version of superglue. Together, the attendant and I took out my radiator and put this magic ointment on the leak, and then reinstalled it. It was clear by the look on this gentleman's face that he wasn't sure if this was going to work or not, but it was our best shot. Considering that the attendant and I weren't sure the solution we'd come up was even going to work at all, I had to come up with a plan B. So I pulled out my phone card and used the payphone at the station to call one of my guys back home. He had told me before I left that if I needed anything at all, he had family in Guanajuato. Now a third of the way into the trip, I knew I had to be getting close to that city, somewhere near central Mexico. It wasn't easy with his broken English and my almost non-existent Spanish, but I managed to explain the situation to him, and I had him alert his family that I would be heading in their direction. It seemed a whole lot less risky to try to make it to Guanajuato than all the way to the beach. I was sure that if I could just get there, things would be all right. Somehow I did in fact make it to the front door of my friend's madre. I'm going to keep this up this whole chapter. Of course, that's mother in Spanish. Hat in hand, just praying that she'd be willing to help. And boy, did she help. The family didn't know any English. And Lord knows, I still didn't know much Spanish. But regardless, they received me with open arms and lots of delicious food. There were corn tortillas, beans like I'd never tasted, and chicken that they'd raised on their small farm. There was also guacamole and homemade pico de gallo and fresh jalapenos. I realized this meal might very well have represented a week's pay for this beautiful family. We ate and laughed and carried on for hours. What I thought would be a quick pit stop ended up being more like 3 or 4 days. Before I hit the road, I tried to give my buddy's mom $100, which at the time would have equated to about 1,000 pesos, the equivalent to a month's wages in Mexico. She refused. She grabbed my face with both hands, pulled me in close, and explained adamantly that she didn't want any money. But she did make me promise before I left that as I traveled, I would pray for her and her family. And somehow, miracle of miracles, I understood exactly what she was saying. Something about our time together impressed me in a really meaningful way and gave me exactly what I needed to get back on my feet and get back on the road. Here I was immersing myself in the Mexican culture and out of pure necessity, also starting to learn the language. At the same time, I was now realizing how homesick I was becoming. Meanwhile, back in Tejas. What I didn't know, of course, was that back in Texas, my master plan was starting to unravel. For me, collecting rent checks from less than responsible college students had become second nature, but I had not prepared Joanna for the amount of begging and pleading that the process required. Although her talent for bookkeeping was unmatched, I had sorely underprepared her for the events that were about to unfold. When the rent checks didn't come in, my subcontractor's checks started bouncing. Vendors started calling. And one by one, my subs started tracking down Joe at her dad's tire shop. It quickly became clear to Joanna why my parents had been a bit opposed to me going to Mexico in the first place. They understood the amount of juggling it took for me to run these businesses, and they knew Joanna wasn't prepared to handle all these assignments in my absence without months of preparation. On top of that, she was finally coming to understand that the inner workings of my businesses weren't all they were cracked up to be. I hadn't been fooling her per se. She just never would have guessed that not being able to collect and deposit 1 month's worth of rent would have caused this much chaos. It had never crossed her mind that I had no backup, no reserve, nada. The money I had taken with me to Mexico was all the money I had in the world. Not surprisingly, Joanna's father was furious. Back then, while we were dating, I referred to Joe's dad as Mr. Stevens. Though he's Jerry to me now, this story still scares me so much that I'd like to revert to calling him Mr. Stevens for the remainder of this chapter. For as long as I had known him, Mr. Stevens had questioned whether I even had a legitimate job. And now, here were all these people standing in the lobby of his tire shop demanding the money I owed them. They were making a scene at his place of business, and Joanna was mortified. To say that Mr. Stevens had an impeccable business reputation in town is an understatement, and here I was compromising that. Thank God this saint of a woman was quick on her feet. She realized exactly what was going on and called my dad in a hurry. Joe actually describes this as the first time she really got to connect with my parents. Even though the whole connection was basically the three of them realizing I was delusional. Joe drove to Dallas to have dinner with my mom and dad and to work the whole thing out on my behalf. They were able to access my bank account and temporarily lend me the money to pay these hardworking people until I could get back to collect this missing rent. I'm really playing it cool here and glossing over some of the emotions, but they were all mad. I had deeply disappointed all the people I most respected. Joanna, my parents, her parents. I'd really screwed this whole thing up. Meanwhile, back in Mexico, things were finally starting to look up. Shiner and I had made it to Playa del Carmen and were getting acclimated to our new lives at this hostel there. I found that I actually enjoyed sitting in a classroom and learning this beautiful language, no matter how much work it took. For the first time in my life, being stuck at a desk wasn't downright miserable. It finally clicked with me that maybe the reason behind learning this language in the first place far outweighed the pain caused by sitting in this classroom day after day. I've heard about parents letting their kids take a gap year after high school, and that idea makes a little sense to me now after my Mexico experience. When you force kids like me to sit in a classroom and learn, they struggle to get anywhere. But after getting away from school and discovering what they're really passionate about, they might actually want to learn. They soak it in. I sometimes wonder why we cram education down our kids' throat when the desire to learn comes and goes sometimes in life. Forcing it seems like a big waste of time to me. I say don't rush it. If it's meant to be, it'll come. I was about 2 weeks into class when I aced my first test. I was all excited to find the nearest payphone to call Jo to tell her about my A. But when Jo answered the phone, she was already shouting, even before the operator finished informing me that she had accepted this international collect call. I would like to add that these collect calls were somewhere around $20 a minute, and I was calling her parents' house. After such an amazing day of learning Spanish on the beach, this was quite the buzzkill. "Your business is a joke," she yelled. "All these people are coming to my dad's shop demanding to be paid, and there's no money. Luckily for you, your dad is bailing out your sorry butt. You have 3 days to get back to Texas, or this relationship is over." Her tone made it clear that she was not playing. My heart was broke. There are hard moments in life when you see yourself for the tonto you are. Of course, that's fool in Spanish. This all felt so much bigger than a few bounce checks. Up until that moment, Jo had really respected me and the work that I did. Even if her dad didn't get it, she found it admirable and courageous that I was an entrepreneur. Now, not so much. Also, I'd spent a good bit of time on the drive to Mexico thinking about when the time might be right to ask Joe's father for her hand in marriage. That dream suddenly felt like it could be slipping away in this very moment. Not to mention, my hope of becoming fluent in Espanol was disappearing as quickly as the sun had just melted beneath the horizon of this heavenly place. The goal that I had set was twofold. Obviously, I wanted to learn the language of my guys, but I also had this feeling that if I could really communicate with them, somehow I'd be able to catch a glimpse into the way that my granddad thought. And maybe, just maybe, I'd be able to understand him just a bit better. So much for both of those goals. Somehow I made it back to Texas in the allotted 3 days, as promised. By the grace of God, that temporary radiator fix was just enough to get me all the way back home. I barely remember the drive. I think I probably white-knuckled that steering wheel, sitting straight up in my seat and trying to will myself home even faster than that truck could move. I drove straight to Joanna's parents' house because I knew she'd be there, and I finally pulled into the driveway at nearly midnight. I was deeply dreading what was about to go down, but there was zero chance I could go home and wait till morning to face the music. If you think I look bad on the cover of this book with my ungroomed beard and mullet, you should have seen me that night. I looked rough. I hadn't showered in like 3 days. Shiner, ever steadfast, remained right there by my side as I walked up to their front door. I carried that stupid lasso with me, hoping my Brahma Bull story would serve to lighten the mood a bit. I quietly tapped on the door, thinking maybe everyone had given up on me and already gone to bed. I had begun to second-guess reconciling everything in the middle of the night like this. Perhaps we should just revisit this whole thing after I had a little rest and a cold shower. The pitiful look on my face must have been powerful, because just as Mr. Stevens opened that door, I witnessed his expression melt from anger to grace. I don't know if you've ever read the story in the Bible about the prodigal son, but this homecoming kind of felt like that. There was no party or celebration awaiting me. However, the acceptance and forgiveness I felt from Mr. Stevens and Mrs. Stevens and my girlfriend that night was so powerful it must have felt somewhat like the prodigal son upon his return. This is my basic synopsis of the prodigal son. This guy leaves home, takes every penny of his inheritance, and hits the road. He acts like a total punk, and then proceeds to quickly blow all of his family's money and becomes destitute. In complete humiliation, he has to go back home and beg his father for forgiveness. When he gets there, he's welcomed back with open arms and a party to celebrate his return. Simply put, I did not get what I deserved. It was actually amazing in a miraculous kind of way. They could tell by the look of defeat on my face that I was embarrassed. Instead of the school's recommended 90 days, I had only made it a few weeks. So as you can imagine, I was far from fluent. which was the only reason I'd gone to Mexico in the first place. And on top of that, now both my family and Joanna's family knew the extreme shortcomings of my businesses. I was operating with very thin margins, and for the first time, that became completely evident to everyone. If everything didn't fire on all cylinders, this frail machine I had built would implode almost instantly. To both my dad and my future father-in-law, paying people on time defined integrity. To them, I had just committed the cardinal sin of business, writing checks in hopes that other deposits would come in, basically robbing Peter to pay Paul. They'd also discovered there was no real bookkeeping going on in any of my businesses. I had a long way to go in regaining their trust and respect, but the grace these men extended to me reframed the very nature of our relationships. It opened the door for the three of us to collaborate on future endeavors. In the coming years, they would become my mentors, partners, and investors in various business opportunities. Before Mexico, I sure like to tell people I was a businessman and an entrepreneur, but there's a big difference between launching a few businesses and actually building something that's sustainable. And by that definition, I wasn't operating even one truly successful business. My intentions in going to Mexico to learn Spanish were sincerely admirable, but to be honest with you, I was also excited about taking a few months off at the beach. I cared about my businesses and my crew big time, but I was still acting like a kid, and they deserved better than that. For the first time, while driving that truck back home with Shiner by my side, and while feeling the sheer humiliation of being found out, I began to sense the gravity of what it takes to run a business, to glimpse what the life of an entrepreneur really requires, and it dawned on me that up until then, I had been pretending. An owner of a young business, or in my case, three businesses, simply can't be on the beach 2,000 miles away. It became very clear to me that I had to grow up and become the leader these businesses needed. Or I thought maybe it was time for me to cash out and sell them. Just count the whole thing as a learning experience. I'll be honest, cashing out felt like the safest, most logical conclusion. The nice thing about working at some corporation is that you get to go to Mexico as soon as you've saved up enough money and accrued enough time off. You don't have to give it a second thought. But when you own a business, all of the responsibility ultimately falls on your shoulders. The buck stops with you every time. Perhaps you've got to be crazy to choose the life of an entrepreneur. I realize that. But you have to be stupid to choose it without ever counting the cost. I look back on that trip as pivotal. I learned some crucial lessons in a short amount of time, and I grew up a lot. After shaking off the doubts, I came back even more motivated than ever to dig in and get after it with these businesses of mine. This was the catalyst I needed to create change. If not for that trip, I'm not sure I would have ever evolved into the businessman I've become. I also realized that I unintentionally put Joe in a terrible spot. No language acquisition or dream trip was worth that. It became my mission to prove to Joe and my parents and her parents and, of course, myself that I could do this, that I was the real deal, and I wouldn't stop until I made this entrepreneurial dream of mine a reality. Who could have guessed that there was so much to learn from one misguided, bullfighting, broken-down trip to Mexico? Chapter 4, Leave and Cleave. I was 26 when Joanna Stevens and I first met. I'd only had a couple of serious relationships at that point, and to be honest, I wasn't really the serious relationship type, mostly because I was managing three businesses simultaneously and didn't have a ton of extra time. But most of my buddies from various phases of my life were already a couple of years into marriage at that point. I think this kind of sped the process along for me, and eventually I started wanting to settle down too. One slight problem, though, I hadn't quite found anyone I wanted to spend the rest of my life with. First time I saw Joanna, I knew for sure that I wanted to date her, but I wouldn't say I knew for sure that she was the one. Several dates in, I still wasn't plotting to buy the ring, and you'd better believe that Joe wasn't exactly planning our wedding either. Not after I'd showed up 2 hours late for our first date. But what I did know from day one was that I wanted to spend time with her again, She intrigued me, and I've never stopped feeling that way. When Joe and I finally got married, we knew we wanted to forge a new path for ourselves. The fact that we'd ended up with four phenomenal parents, people who loved us and supported us, is rare. They have sacrificed for us in ways that, looking back, still brings tears to our eyes. We understand how uncommon that is, and we do not take our parents or our upbringings for granted. Since beginning life together, we have wanted to take the best of what each of our parents taught us and the best of our own guidance.